Hi, I'm Chad Hughes, and you're listening to Elevated Access, the Inside Story. This episode, I met with Dave Gold, a mediation professional with 32 years of experience in helping others resolve conflict. A lawyer by training, Dave shares his path to mediator and some of the work he has done relative to access. He breaks down the nature of conflict, the approach of unpacking our story, and he takes us to a place he calls Rumi's Field. He shares practical advice for not only dealing with conflict, but preparing for it ahead of time. This episode is packed full of advice that you can't miss. So let's tune in now to the conversation with Dave. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chad. I appreciate being here.
Well, I'm so glad that you and I were introduced. Shout out to Mark Bradley for doing that. What we're going to lean into today is we're going to lean into the topic of conflict. And in the type of work that we do whenever we're acquiring access for a development, there are times where we run into conflict, and it can be at various levels. And I think there's a lot to unpack around the topic of this. And given your 32 years of being a mediator and oftentimes helping people like myself or those in my profession, I think we're going to have a great conversation on this today. So why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about your background and how you ended up becoming a mediator?
Sure. I graduated from law school in 1975 and articled in Calgary, and then went to Banff and started a practice with two of my friends who were already up there. That practice went fine. Banff, of course, is a tourist town and a small town. So I had a very general practice. I did the federal prosecutions. I prosecuted drugs, and I prosecuted Parks Canada issues for a number of years. Just generally, though, it was a small town. So as a consequence, the litigation always troubled me because I was usually engaged with someone I might see in the grocery store. So I began to think about ways to do things differently. And in 1988, I went through my own midlife crisis. I got myself a divorce. I didn't buy a red sports car, but I did move to Calgary. And one day I ran into a fellow on the street in 1988, and he told me about mediation and some training that was being offered. So I took that training, mediation training. I hadn't even understood what the word meant until I took the training. And I was so enamored with it that I decided to shift my practice to focus on mediation. And in fact, I went to work with another gentleman, and we started a business called Canadian Dispute Resolution Corporation, which between 1988 and 2000, we mediated across Canada in Toronto and Vancouver and Calgary and Edmonton with offices. And we trained some 150 mediators to work with us. And we did over 13,000 insurance cases. It was focused on the insurance industry. And it was very successful until the industry decided that no fault and other types of programs to limit claims were more effective, and so I shifted my focus at that time to work with the Alberta Energy and Utilities Board in 1999, and designed for them, with them, I guess, an appropriate dispute resolution process, which was their focus for what at that time was called ADR, alternate dispute resolution. They didn't like the term alternate because the board process was, of course, appropriate. And so they wanted to have another appropriate dispute resolution process that occurred before the parties got to the hearing steps. And that involved me in working with the AUB to train some 300 of their staff to be in-house facilitators. And those facilitations were quite successful in reducing the number of hearings. And their reports have been out for years on the success of that program. Mm-hmm. In fact, they got some awards. We got some awards for doing it. And then since then, I've just been mediating for, of course, most of the mediation is done because I am a lawyer by background, with law firms, all sorts of conflicts from family estate transitions to business disputes to wrongful dismissal, you name it, and I've done it. In 2000, and I think it was about 13 or 14, I went over to Albania and did a mediation in Albania with I don't speak Albanian, but they have a very large mediation group attached to the government. So I worked with one of their mediators and helped an oil company deal with a number of communities around their particular project. So that was fascinating. It was quite controversial. I remember being sat down in the office of the oil company and showing a drone that had bullet holes in it because somebody had shot it out of the sky. That was how controversial it was.
Wow.
So lots of very interesting stories, and we'll probably get into some of them.
Yeah. So I'm curious about, and I often ask this question of my guests, you know, along the way, you know, what you described there, 13,000 cases over about a 12-year period with a team focused on the insurance industry. But my sense is that you probably, with that volume of cases dealing with conflict of different types, that you probably started to see some patterns emerge, or even maybe for yourself, started to develop your own philosophies around how to deal with different types of conflict. Can you explain? Is there more of a story there?
The main story is conflict is inevitable and everywhere. We're just going to have it in our lives. There's a good test for conflict. You breathe on a mirror. If it fogs over, you have conflict somewhere in your life because you're alive. As far as the philosophy is concerned, the insurance world was a bit unique because if you think about it, it involves usually an accident. And the person who is the defendant is represented by the insurance company. And the plaintiff and the defendant may never even ever meet. They might not even be sure of each other's names for that matter. The dispute is between the insurance professional, who has a very narrow box or window of what they're prepared to do to settle the case, and the plaintiff. And so mediation in that experience was largely an exercise in giving the plaintiff an opportunity to feel heard and tell their story of how injured they were. And the adjuster hopefully supported to do a good job of listening and acknowledging that. And then providing a bit of a reality check for what was realistic in terms of the litigation and having the parties settle. So those mediations, many of them, most of them were short, 2 to 4 hours, and involved an adjuster, sometimes a defense counsel, and a plaintiff's counsel and the plaintiff. Mm. And one early lesson from that was, in fact, my first insurance mediation, very first one in 1988, with a very senior adjuster and his very senior lawyer. And the husband arrived, his wife had delivered him. He completed the mediation. We got it settled. It took about 4 hours. His wife came to pick him up. And when she found out what he'd settled for, she was furious. She blew up and said, there's no way we're doing this. We're going blah, blah, blah. The other side was sophisticated enough to re-engage in mediation. We went back in for another hour and a half and had her understand how we got to the number. So it was taking her from being frustrated and angry and frightened to a place of understanding. And largely that's what happens in mediations, is it's about creating a playing field of understanding that allows the parties to co-create good solutions for the future.
Well, let's dive into the conflict piece. And I'd like to start with maybe you providing some context around the nature of conflict.
Sure, because as I said earlier, it's inevitable, it's everywhere. And it can be framed initially as a difficult conversation, and sometimes even a difficult negotiation. So the conflict is created by the stories that the parties have about what happened to them and what they made it mean. So for nature of conflict, a simple example, you're at a hockey game arena. It's a 15-year-old hockey game, late season. The teams are tied. The stands are filled with family and friends. And the referee misses a call at the blue line, and one team scores to win the game. Now, in that moment, by virtue of the events, half that audience is outraged at the referee, and half is ecstatic because their team won. So if you were talking to them the next day, you would expect to hear very different stories about what happened and what they made it mean from the two parties. And both of them would be, in their own minds, in their own experience, correct, right. And the focus would be on fault and blame and right and wrong. And if you think about it, that focus is on the past. It's looking backwards to events and describing and holding on to those events in our minds. And those events become the drivers for our creation of the future. Because if we stay focused on fault and blame, and we hire lawyers and the arguments they make are about proving the fault and blame, then our future becomes about a lot of conflict. And so truly at the center of and the nature of conflict is a shift, if you like, from the past and what happened and fault and blame and right and wrong and all the drama that we share with our friends and family and get them on our side and our lawyers and get them on our side. A shift of the conversation from that, based on a quality of understanding of what happened. Like, I want to know how you see it, Chad. You want to know how I see it, but not for who's right or wrong, but for understanding. I need to understand how you see it, and vice versa. Mm. That shift then allows for a co-creation of the parties of a future that is about solution and resolution and a better path forward and all sorts of things, including business plans and repaired relationships and repaired families and so on. And so at its simplest, what a mediator does is help the parties share their stories of fault and blame for right and wrong and shift the focus to the now. And in the now, share stories for understanding and then shift the focus to the future and how do we solve this together. Mm.
Very well explained, Dave. Even reflecting on some of my own circumstances in the past, I don't know if it's human nature or not. I think it is. That desire to rally people around the way you see things, you know, it's sure. Almost comforting if you can find people that will be on board with, yeah, I agree with you. I see things that way too. And that may not always lead to the best resolution if you've got a conflict with somebody. It's the opposite of trying to understand their side of the story.
Exactly. And part of the challenge with people with conflict is that they truly do believe that they're right. They have a judgment about the other side, the fault and blame, and the other side won't be fair or is dishonest or whatever. And as long as that polarization stays in place, the conflict, it's like yeast in the fridge. It's going bad on you over time. After 32 years, I've done a tremendous number of mediations. A lot of them, unfortunately, in the late stages of the litigation process, lawyers would go through a bunch of the steps they deem necessary to establish and prove your side of the story to a judge or an arbitrator, and finally get to the place where they're prepared to consider a resolution and they hire a mediator. And I've done a lot of those. Unfortunately, a lot of the damage already been done. I saw families torn apart and businesses go bankrupt from the cost of the litigation, the damage of the lawsuit, and friendships destroyed. I, in fact, myself was involved in a business endeavor a few years back that ended up in litigation. You know, the shoemaker's children have no shoes.
Yeah.
I did my best to get a conversation happening, but there was a number of parties and they were locked in. And we spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. So not only do I believe it because I've been mediating and seen it, I believe it because I have had it impact me personally.
Right. So one of the things you've shared with me and you talk about in your guide, and I'll mention that later for our guests so they're aware of this guide that you've developed.
Sure.
But one of the things you talk about in that guide is unpacking your story. Could we spend a little time on that?
The guide occurred in part because of what I just shared about 32 years of seeing late mediations. The earlier one gets to deal with and engage with their own conflict, the better. And so what the guide does is it says to parties in dispute, here are some steps that you can take for yourself, and by all means engage. If you've been enrolling your friends or your family, have them engage with you in this, but have them engage with you to support you, to be objective about it. And so in a sense, you take your story, and there's a simple tool. You take a blank sheet of paper, write a line down the middle, and with the help of friends or on your own, tell the story. Write down the story, but only what happened, just the facts. And I invite people to be really diligent in saying, this happened, this is a fact, and I know that because, not judgment and interpretation, but actual proof. Because if you actually get into the litigation, of course, your lawyer is going to be focused on that list big time in helping you decide what you could prove and how you would prove it. And that's where things get really messy and expensive. So you take a piece of paper, write a line down the middle, on the left side, just the facts. And then on the right side, write down your meanings, your judgments, your interpretations, your assumptions. Because most conflict exists on the right-hand side of the page. Most of the factual conflict can be relatively simply determined. And so I invite people to do that separation. But then that's not quite enough. As best as they might be at being objective, it's only half the story. So then I invite themselves to put themselves in the other person's shoes, to walk a mile in their shoes, and to try and with the same sheet of paper, write a line down the middle on the left-hand side, your best guess, and it is a guess, as to what they see are the facts, just the facts. And on the right-hand side of the page, write down what you think based on, because there's engagement there. It's not just blowing up in the street like an insurance claim. Write down your interpretation of their judgments, interpretations, and assumptions. And then take those two sheets of paper and do an analysis of it, to ask the simple question, what's really most important here? What are the interests and needs and concerns that I see for myself and my story and their story? And what do I think their interests and needs and concerns are? Because those interests and needs are what you want your future to look like. In the litigation mindset, that would be, the judge is going to agree with me and I'm going to get ding, 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 ding. Maybe yes, maybe no. In my years as a litigator, and I did some of it, certainly, I won cases that I shouldn't have and lost cases that I shouldn't have. So there's no certainty in litigation. In fact, one of the most important pieces of information a lawyer learns, even these days, especially in these days, is the name of the judge that's just been appointed to your case. Because judges are human, they put their pants on one leg at a time, and they have their own judgments and assumptions. So sometimes the name of the judge is really important, because mm-hmm. the lawyer knows their history and knows that they are either going to be more for you or more against you. And I think most lawyers would agree with that. Not all. Some of them would protect the sanctity of judges, but they're just human beings, and they have their own judgments and assumptions. Yeah. And unfortunately, if you leave it to them, they'll give you your future, but you might not like it.
Yeah. So when a person sits down and does this exercise, it occurs to me that it would help that person with that shift in mindset by doing the other side. Is that a starting point to?
You know, sure it is. Sure it is. It's the beginning of the shift from fault and blame and right and wrong. Because if our story, however we've written it down, if we stay stuck with it, interpret it and judge it as fault and blame and right and wrong, then we're stuck in the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to reach outside ourselves to a judge or an arbitrator via lawyers. And that's expensive and time consuming and in many ways damaging.
Right.
By doing this exercise, though, we're really asking ourselves and our family to support us in this, to step back from the problem and shift the focus from I'm right and they're wrong to, okay, how do they see it and how do I see it and how do we have conversations about how we see it that can lead us to finding a solution. And because the guide is intended to be a tool for people really early in the conflict, before it has gotten so toxic, I think it has an excellent chance of being effective at having people take a step back and go to what I refer to as Rumi's field. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. So in my experience, a mediation is Rumi's field. It's a place for conversations and dialogue to share stories for understanding and meaning without the drama of fault and blame and right and wrong, and shift that conversation to looking at the interests and needs and concerns that have been analyzed in the guide and proposing solutions for the future, generating options. It's a brainstorming session. Can we do this? Can we do this? Would this work? Apply practical tools to that, like standards. The oil industry, of course, has a lot of regulatory standards that it has to face. And so as a mediator, I would often be helping the parties not create a solution that the regulator wouldn't agree to.
Right.
Right. And that conversation also occurs in Rumi's field with the mediator. The guide is intended for people to use on their own. But it's an excellent tool for preparing for lawyers and for preparing for outreach to a medium and to do that early.
I love this concept of Rumi's field. Do you introduce that when you're in a mediation with people? Do you introduce that type of thinking fairly early on as a place you want to get to?
Yeah, I do. I think that there are opportunities at the front end of a mediation before you've actually engaged with the parties together to sit down with them and design what you're going to do together. And that's where I raise that notion. I might not quote Rumi for it, but I'm certainly talking about my role as being a facilitator of dialogue about the future and not a debate about the past and fault and blame. I acknowledge that they have their stories to share. I let them know that I'm going to help them share those stories for understanding rather than who's right or wrong. And I share with them that I will be their coach, their evaluator, their support to get over the roadblocks and barriers. Mm-hmm. That conversation varies if I've got a couple of experienced litigators in the room representing the parties, or if I've just got the parties or whomever else is there. They may have family members. And so the Rumi field description expands to accommodate their unique needs. And I think that's important because an awful lot of mediations, the mediator is booked by the lawyers for Tuesday, the 23rd of whatever, and shows up and walks in the room with supposedly some kind of magic wand that makes the parties do things differently.
Right.
So I think that the preparation in the front end makes a big difference in how successful mediation can be.
Yeah, I would agree. You in your guide, you talk about the difference between dialogue and debate. It seems to me that if you're preparing people ahead of time with these tools, it seems to me that it may naturally take you into dialogue and avoid debate because of how you're setting the stage. Is that fair, or is there more to it?
Well, that's fair. We by nature, and some of us more than others, love debate. One of the interesting things about parties and stuff is people get into a debate over whatever the issue is, and everybody has a cell phone, so now they can look up and get the actual facts, right? The facts are always at our fingertips. So debate is not wrong, and it's lots of fun at the right time. But if it causes us to stay focused on our past and conflict, it's doing it harm. And so that message to trigger, let's just talk about what happened in not so much a benign way, but a way of sharing our stories. Some people are quite willing to say to the other side, I don't understand why you feel the way you do. Please help me understand it.
Mm.
In the debate environment, if you think about a debate, it's you talk, I talk, you talk, I talk, you talk, I talk. Or I do a diatribe and then you do a diatribe. And there's very little communication happening in the debate. It's just not so much shouting each other down, but it's articulating the logic from our brain as to why we're right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. At the end of the day, through a very sophisticated production of documents and questioning and submissions to the court, you're in a sense having a debate before the judge. Only your lawyer's doing the talking. And the judge is going to interpret that based on his or her experience and tell you what your future is going to be like. And that is a luckless and unfortunate process, in my view. I have greatest respect for the litigators. They're doing a great job. But there is always going to be an opportunity for resolution of the conflict, short of the courthouse steps. And a very senior litigator, he's retired now, shared that Gould, he said, my clients are ready to settle when they're more pissed off at my fees than they are at the other side. and unfortunately, that is a very poor reason to choose mediation and a resolution.
Yeah. So I'm getting a sense of how you fit in this, in the center of, let's just say, in the center of conflict as a mediator. Can you tell us more about, like, and maybe even walk us through an example or something to give us a sense of, okay, from start to finish, what's your role and how are you, you know, how are you behaving through that process? What are you, you know, and things you're watching for, where you intervene, just, yeah, maybe paint the picture for us on how this works.
Firstly, if people are asking me what's the role of a mediator, I'm opining that it has got three parts to it. The first part is facilitator of that shift from debate to dialogue, and we've talked quite a bit about that. That facilitation role is really reflecting back to people the core of what they are saying and helping them to unpack the drama from it and just get to that shared story. And so mediators are good at listening and reflecting and reframing conversations in a way that allows the conversation to shift into Rumi's field, to shift into that future. The second thing I think we do effectively is we structure ourselves as a referee. We have the mediation agreement, where, because mediation is voluntary. So when people sign my mediation agreement, they are giving me permission to play three roles. First, I've described as facilitator. The second is referee. So I don't have a whistle, but I do stop the ineffective conversations. I take breaks and caucuses if somebody's got quite a bit of emotion happening. I sit down with them and work through what's triggered their... Because what's happened, of course, is, if you think about it, I'm trying to keep them in Rumi's field. Something happens to one side and they're triggered. And the trigger is like taking their head and going zap back into the past. And now they're stuck back there in their story and they're outraged or umbraged about what went on. So part of my task is, as the referee, is to take them to the dressing room and work through the drama and get them to see the possibilities that we've been working towards and bring them back into the room and perhaps do that with both sides. So that's the referee role and the caucus role. And then last but not least is the evaluation role. And it's because I've been doing this a long time, I'm often asked to have an opinion. I don't like that word because that's just making me sound like I'm a judge of some kind. But I do offer questioning that evaluates or helps them evaluate the position that they're holding. And the position might be about some particular facts. So you're holding this position because you think this happened, but remember when we were talking, it maybe looked like this, so perhaps that position isn't as strong as you think. And if there are lawyers in the room, they might invite me to opine on how they see the legal side of it, legal roadblock, and to help them work with their client to get past that. Mm-hmm. So three roles: facilitator, referee, evaluator.
That's helpful.
And in action, what that looks like is, I did a case between an oil company that wanted to build an extension to its gas processing facilities way up north. The local landowner didn't own the land where the plant was, but the access road crossed his land, and he was very much an environmentalist. He was a Tesla driver and was very strongly of the view that we needed to do many things to support solving climate change. And I had meetings with both sides beforehand about Rumi's field and the theme and theory. And interestingly, this particular landowner thought that was great. He he recognized, he said he recognized, and this is part of the evaluation step, even before we got in the room, that the regulator was likely to approve this, that the rationale the company had for expanding the plant made sense to him. He just didn't like it because of climate change. And the vice president that they sent, because I had suggested they sent somebody really senior who could bind the company. And they did a great job of creating plans to turn down the lights that shone on his property from the just a bunch of very practical things that were connected to the environment, but didn't stop the project. And at the end of a full day session, they had an agreement, including some compensation for inconvenience. And in fact, they sent during the construction phase, his wife and him to Hawaii for to get them away from the project while they did some particularly loud, noisy, and disruptive renovations.
When we're headed out to meet with a new stakeholder or landowner, we've got an access professional, and as far as we know, there's no conflict that exists yet, at least surrounding our particular project. What can those people do in advance? Are there tools they can use well in advance of even meeting with somebody that would help set the stage for conflict if it arises, or is there a point where it's premature and it shouldn't even be brought up?
Well, I'm sure there is a premature component to it, but at some point in time, your team member is presented with a story from the company. And there is nothing that prevents him or her from doing a little bit of the initial unpacking of that story into what are the facts and what are the interpretations. Because the company's engineers and the people that have put together and say, we need to do this, let's say it's a pipeline, we need it to go here and we need it to be so deep because the regulator, blah, blah, blah. So very much your team member is handed a story. And if they simply be aware that that's what it is, a story, and the other side may well have a different story. So they think a little bit about what are the facts, what are the basic facts that I would need to have at my fingertips? And then what is the company telling me about how they're going to deal with those facts? And I want to have an understanding of that. So the separation is actually a good way for your team member to think about the steps. And now they are in the room with or gotten into contact. I'm assuming that you go out in the field and you meet.
Yep.
Perhaps in their kitchen over the cup of coffee. I would, if it was me, share to them, look, I have a mandate from my company to do a particular project, high level conversation about it here. But I'm really wanting to be part of a solution that works for you too. So with that sort of general just starting point, what would be the main concerns you might have? And as they talk, I'd be trying to break it down between facts and meanings. Mm. And reflecting back, so for you, the location of the pipeline means this and this and this, right? The fact is that the pipeline has to go a certain depth. You're okay with that. And you're just parceling out what's a potential for conflict and what's simply a fact that that both sides can agree to.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I think sometimes the landmen are accused, probably sometimes properly so, by being very direct. We have to have this, and the only issue here is how much we're going to pay you or whatever. And so the conversation becomes polarized. And unfortunately, that land agent is known then to be that way, and you have a problem with the credibility of the land agent. I've done many mediations where the landowner refused to have the land agent that had been dealing with them as part of the mediation. That was a precondition. They wanted somebody from the company that they could have a conversation with. And in one sense, that makes sense because the decision maker is then there. But a lot of times there was a fair amount of bad feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. What came to mind when you were sharing that is I thought about this idea of fear-based like a fear-based negotiation or even just say environment. And I think sometimes that can be created by the developer that an agent is representing. And I remember in my earlier years having a sense of fear around basically not doing my job well. And we had different clients we worked for, and some were pretty good at getting hot under the collar, and others were more patient. And so it created this underlying fear, an undercurrent of fear, which then I think sort of impeded an approach that might be more collaborative, because it's like, I just need to get this thing signed and I can't go over these thresholds or else I'm in big trouble. How often have you seen that or identified that as a factor to the issues?
Chad, I think a lot, and it probably speaks to my previous diatribe about the preparation by your agent. Because when you think about it, what you've just described is the company saying, this is what happened, these are the meanings, and we're right, and they're wrong, and your job is to go out there and carry that can and a big stick and make sure that we get what we need. That's not an unpacked conversation. So the first step for your team in that instance is to work with the proponent to have them understand a little bit more about Rumi's field, understand a little bit more about the best approach to get a good result here. Almost all projects today with the oil and gas sector, of course, the AER still has a right of access mandate. And so there's a pretty big club there in the sense that that some kind of project is going to be on your land in all likelihood. And as a consequence, repackaging that to meet the true interests and concerns and needs of the party is very important. Moving a pipeline from one side of their pasture to the other might be the best thing possible. But if it never gets on the table, how would you know?
Mm-hmm. I think what just occurred to me is that a signed document cannot be the only measure of success. And I think that environment has changed over the years, where most developers realize the importance of the rapport and the trust and that relationship that they really carry on into the future with them, well past our involvement oftentimes. And so, but if the only measure of success is a signed agreement, that in itself sort of lends itself to this pressure, this fear-based approach to, I got to get a deal done. And I think oftentimes it can be at the expense of the relationship with those people that you're dealing with.
Yes, absolutely. The fear is really being stuck in that story of the past and fault and blame, whether it's been handed to you by your client and imposed on you, or whether your own lack of preparation has left you stuck there. But if that's the case and you simply finagle a deal, you walk away, I don't think feeling all that good about it. Certainly the relationship is damaged. I mean, that's why a lot of late stage mediation left the parties with a lot of damage. They wouldn't talk to each other after that. Yes, they had gotten out of the lawsuit and they had a deal, but they hated it. And that left the stories around the dinner table for a long time afterwards quite toxic. So I do believe the industry is much better today and working hard to build relationships, and it needs to. And in the current social media and environmental environment, that's probably more important than it's ever been.
Let's talk about that. I'd like to kind of broaden this discussion just for a moment and just get your perspective or your insights on the world we're living in today. From my point of view, the current environment that we're in is a very, there's a lot of right versus wrong, good versus evil, sort of dialogue, I suppose. And it's, you know, climate change is an area of that. Of course, things related to the pandemic, there's lots of right versus wrong conversations having there. And I think the list goes on.
Yes.
What Like, what do you make of that? Is there a turning point for us as a society where we start to look at things differently? Or maybe the other question I have for you is, has it actually always been this way?
It's a great question, and I've thought quite a bit about that. I have two things that I believe are a useful part of this discussion, this dialogue. First is that the tools that we now have, TikTok and social media and Twitter and so on, are tools of debate. By their nature, they limit the conversations to short, punchy bullets, which if you think about it is a debate environment. And so it isn't and hasn't been, unfortunately, a great environment for dialogue, for actual exchange of ideas. And COVID made that worse because it meant that we couldn't get face-to-face. And so the use of the tools, and I've been involved many times where the exchange of emails, as an example, was fostering the debate to the point where they broke down and couldn't talk anymore. The communication was completely gone because each side had this bucket of the other side's emails proving that they were, and then defined by right, wrong, fault, and blame, but usually with four-letter words.
Right.
So the tools are supporting debates and partially also responsible for my second concern, and this one is deeply felt by me. We've lost the trust in truth. The tools and unfortunately Donald Trump's presidency and so many other things that have occurred, we manufacture our truths and argue for them without any true seeking of the real truth or the actual truth, the actual what happened. Mm-hmm. And so we've lost truth, and that scares the hell out of me because it leaves us functionally polarized to the point of no way forward. Because in a dialogue, we're sharing story for understanding to get clear on what are the real facts, the real truth, so that we can use that as a basis for creating a plan and steps to the future. And if our planning is all false drama and back and forth, the future is all screwed up.
Right.
We don't know where we're going with.
Yeah.
Just at my age, I'm dismayed at that. Mm-mm. Because it's worse now, I think, than it's ever.
Yeah, well, that's really well put. That last part really struck a chord with me around truth. It used to be that you look to the media to hold everybody accountable. I think like that was the role of the reporter was to really dig into and find the truth. But we seem to have gone a bit sideways on that too today, where between that and social media and Google, where you can basically find support for any angle you want to take, and many of which maybe aren't based in truth, it leads to a pretty scary environment, pretty bumpy road. And yeah,
it does. And of course reality and the truth is tricky. One example that maybe speaks to this, I'm not sure because it just popped into my head, but we did a mediation involving the drilling of a gas well, and the meeting was held in a community hall with some of the community members in the oil company. And as we were arriving, you could see off in the distance a great big fire flare. Because a well from another company is visible to this building, was burning out of control, and so the conversation in the room was about how safe the drilling of the well was, and you looked out the window and here was absolute proof that in some instances it wasn't safe. So it made for an interesting discussion because it had been set up to be a conversation about a safe well, and it ended up being a conversation about reality.
Right. Yeah. Well, I probably digressed us a little bit there, dipping my toe in that water, but I do think there's relevance, and I hope our listeners think about conflict on a broader perspective as a result of that?
Well, that's what the guide is all about. It was simply my effort, and I'm trying to, it's free, anybody can have it. They keep it on the table, and when one of those difficult conversations occurs, whether it's between a brother and a sister over mom's estate or whatever it is, they pull the guide out and prepare for those difficult conversations, those difficult negotiations, before they get in. Because once you've triggered and locked into the conflict, it changes the whole experience you have of your life.
Yeah.
So if you want to be happy and fulfilled in the future, my mom always told me, as simple as I think many mothers have, would you rather be right or would you rather be close?
Right. Yeah.
And mediation is an attempt to get close.
Yeah.
And some people will go, the other side is wrong. And then the tools today help them foster that.
So love that.
It's not easy.
Yeah, no.
It takes discipline and it takes courage. It takes a lot of courage, actually, to use the guide fully, I think. It's easier to be fighting.
I mean, I think you've unpacked a lot of advice here so far, but is there something you would point to leave our listeners with here that would help them?
Rumi's field is fundamentally an expression of curiosity, where early in something happening and someone's doing something that's offside as far as you're concerned, don't like it, and it's upsetting, it's a difficult conversation, it's a difficult negotiation, it's maybe even a full-blown conflict. The first thing that I would invite people to do is be curious about why. How do they see it such that I'm having this reaction? So, in a sense, to take their own emotion and set it aside long enough to, and then in my world, pick up the guide and go through the work of figuring out what happened and what you made it mean, taking a look at why you made it mean that way, and asking yourself why they mean it that way, and then reaching out to the other side with an invite. It's not a demand. Lots of times amongst lawyers, it looks like it. It's an invite to have a conversation about the future and what's possible, rather than a debate about the past and fault and blame. And I invite in my guide people to do that, to call up the other side or have their lawyer call up the other side and say, look, this is not about us being weak. We can fight this all the way to the courts if we have to. But it seems to me there's an opportunity here for us to sit down and just really get clear on what did happen and why it happened and how it happened and how that understanding can then be based on a solution that would work for your client or for you, Bob, and for me. So I hope you're not so angry at me that you can't do this if I'm talking to the person personally. And so that's my piece of advice. It's just you got to reach out to try and solve it before you get locked into they're wrong and I'm right and I'm going to kick their ass.
Something just came to my mind. I need to ask you, if there are listeners listening to this podcast that are thinking, you know, I'd like to pursue a career in as a mediator.
Sure.
What advice would you give those people?
Well, the Justice Institute, the Mount Royal College programs, there are mediation and negotiation training programs offered through a number of institutes, the University of Calgary included. And so they could reach out and take some training. And there's actually a certificate program that can become a certified mediator after quite an extensive amount of training and experience, but it's there. So that's certainly a possibility.
Okay.
I do some in-house training programs for companies that sort of have a notion that they'd like to be more conflict competent. In other words, they have enough of those difficult conversations coming at their teams that they'd like the teams to be more aware and more skilled in the communication and the dialogue component of communication.
Yep.
And so they do some training and some in-house coaching by someone like me. There are others that do conflict coaching. But I think that that's becoming a bigger opportunity for companies.
Yeah.
It was set back somewhat by COVID because, of course, people weren't doing much in the way of training. Zoom, programs, of
course,
but not nearly to the degree that they were.
Yeah. Well, then on that, I think it would be appropriate to do two things here as we close. I want to make sure that people can reach you so that if they, you know, if they need support with mediation on something, if they would like to engage with you with some training, or if they'd like to get a copy of the guide, which I have, and I've found it quite interesting and useful. And what's the best way to reach you?
My website, I think, is the access for all of this, www.davidgouldmediation.com. And it's got the guide on it. It's got a whole bunch of blogs and articles on various aspects, including, interestingly, the nature of conflict. And it's got contact information for me, and it's got a services section that sets out conflict coaching and training and my mediation practice. So that's the best and simplest way, is just to Google my website. And I think it's relatively easy to navigate.
Great. Well, we will include that in the show notes page with this episode so that our listeners can find that easy and engage with you easily.
Thank you. That's appreciated. There's no cost to the guide. In fact, I think that if I understand the technology, they can download it right off the website.
Great.
Or let me know and I'll send it to them.
Okay, awesome. Well, Dave, I think that's a wrap. Thanks so much for coming on the show today. Every time I sit down with you, I take another nugget away, and I just find it so useful.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's a message that I think we need more today than maybe ever before. So hopefully it'll propagate.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you, Dave.